Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Did you know that as more people listen to WNYC on the internet, our bandwidth expenses go up? Please do your part to support WNYC's online services. Click the ePledge button to make your gift now. And thanks.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Well, where in history do you wish you had been? So many people have had these fantasies, have you? And now history maven Byron Hollingshead has compiled a book of essays by historians and writers of historical fiction simply called I Wish I'd Been There. 20 historians bring to life dramatic events that changed America, published by Doubleday. So we will talk now to Byron Hollingshead, the editor, and two contributors to the book, historian Mary Beth Norton from Cornell and historian and historical fiction writer Kevin Baker, about where they wish they had been. And in a few minutes, we'll take your calls. Where in history would you go as a fly on the wall if you could? And what would you hope to learn? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 is our phone number. Kevin Baker is a freelance writer and historian who lives in New York City, the setting for his City of Fire trilogy of novels. He's been here before, Dreamland, Paradise Alley, and Stryver's Row, which is based on, in part on the life of the young Malcolm X. And in fact, the place in history he chooses to go back to is a meeting around the founding of the Nation of Islam. And Mary Beth Norton is the Mary Donlan Alger Professor of American History at Cornell University and has written a number of books in early American history. Among them is In the Devil's Snare, a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize in History and winner of the Ambassador Book Award in American Studies. And sure enough, she wants to go right back into the Devil's Snare and into the Salem Witch Trials era. So Mary Beth Norton, Kevin Baker, Byron Hollingshead, welcome to WNYC today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Byron, what inspired this collection?
Well, it's my own connection with the I wish I'd been there kind of theme. I mean, there's nothing new about this. Time machines have been around for a long time, going both forward and backward. But back in 1985, when I was at American Heritage magazine, the editor of the magazine, I was president, was another Byron Dobell. And we asked about 500 historians to write 100 to 150 words on the I Wish I'd Been There. It was very, very interesting. We got a tremendous response. We didn't pay them anything. It was just full of really interesting ideas about where they would have been. C. Van Woodward, for example, said he would like to have been inside the mind of Robert E. Lee when he was offered the generalship of the Union armies. So we decided a little over a year ago that it would be very interesting to have historians and perhaps some historical novelists who really qualified as historians to take a longer shot at this. So the essays in this volume are 3,000 to 4,000 words, some a bit more than that. And so the subjects are explored much more fully.
Wait a minute. I didn't know that Robert E. Lee ever was offered Union Army after the war?
No. Before the war, Lincoln offered Lee the generalship of the Union armies, and he agonized over it. But finally, he decided that his main loyalty was to his state, Virginia. As Grant said, you know, he's a great general, but it was one of the worst causes that any great general ever fought for.
But I guess it would have been a political coup if he had said yes.
Absolutely.
To recruit Lee with his stature in the Confederacy.
Absolutely.
To lead the Union Army. So, Mary Beth Norton, you chose the Salem Witch Trials, about which you have written an entire book, as I mentioned. Why do you wish you'd been there?
Well, as I say in the essay, there's many unanswered questions, even though we have thousands of documents about the Salem Witch Trials. There are things we don't know, some very, very basic things, and then some general things, and I talk about both in the essay. One of the very basic things we don't know about the witch trials is who presided over them. The actual trial records have disappeared, and so although we know the law said, or the provision that set up the court, that there were 9 judges and that 5 of them had to be present at any given time, we have no idea whether all 9 were there all the time, some of the time, if 5 were there, which 5. So just very basic things like that we absolutely don't know the answer to. But to my mind, what's more interesting even is just to have experienced the atmosphere in Salem, in northern New England, in the in 1692, because I argue in my book that people in that era were desperately afraid of an Indian war that was going on just to the north of them, and I really want to know whether that's right. I want to know whether I read the documents correctly, and I would wish I had been. One of the things I do in my essay is I reconstruct certain crucial moments, the execution of the man who was reputed to be the ringleader of the witches, the famous trial of Rebecca Nurse, where the jury first returned a verdict of acquittal and the judges sent them back to rethink, and then they convicted her, and then also a famous sermon that was given in the middle of everything, and tried to imagine what it would have been like to be in the middle of all of that. I mean, it would have been terrifying, but it also would have been very exciting, and I would really love to have known what it was actually like.
Now, this is not something, one of the things you just said, is not something that people usually learn in their cursory, history lessons on the Salem Witch Trials, that there was an Indian war going on at the time, and that this may have had something to do with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I discovered when I was researching my book, and frankly, my friends and I have all say that the Indians abducted my book. I mean, I didn't intend to write a book about an Indian war. But as I got more and more into the documents, I realized that a number of the people who were involved in the Salem witchcraft trials were not from Salem at all. They were from Maine. They were refugees from the Indian War. Some of the crucial accusers who were servant girls living in Salem Village were actually women whose families had been wiped out. Some of them had been very, very wealthy families in Maine, but they were serving as servants because everything in the family had been lost. Their parents had been killed. Their grandparents had been killed. All the family wealth had been lost to the Indians. And when they said they saw the devil in the shape of an Indian, let me say a light bulb went off in my head about it and how important the Indian War must have been to what was going on.
And Kevin Baker, you chose a meeting between the founders of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad and Wallace Fard Muhammad. Now, you don't seem, from reading this essay, like particularly a follower of Minister Farrakhan. So how'd you get so interested in this?
I got very interested in researching the last historical novel I did, Stryver's Row, which, as you mentioned, is in good part about the life of the young Malcolm X, and set in Harlem in 1943, and I wanted to find out, you know, where he was coming from and where the Nation of Islam came from. And it's really one of the most extraordinary religions in our history, another kind of American-invented religion, right up there with Joseph Smith inventing Mormonism and, a number of other, just fascinating American cults.
So you put this interestingly in the context of African American history, that was obviously an enslaved people brought over and then kind of spoon-fed the white man's religion, Christianity, very successfully and very indigenously accepted it, and adapted it for their own purposes, but not in every case.
It's a rejectionist faith, really.
The Nation of Islam,
yeah, and that's one of the extraordinary things about it. And you read some of the theology And on the surface, it sounds, you know, completely nutty. I mean, the idea that the belief that the black man is the original man evolved from a spinning atom 76 million years ago, and that you know, whites were invented by Dr. Jacob, the big head scientist, who and then triumphed through the science of trichnology, you know, and on like this. But it's in fact, you know, no weirder, as James Baldwin pointed out, that most of the things in many different, you know, kind of established religions, and it's, you know, and it's again part of this kind of fascinating African American tradition of taking these white men's religions that were forced upon them and converting them to their own usage. I mean, in for the most part, this meant inventing black Christianity. Which is, you know, I think the most dynamic form of Christianity still, you know, being practiced in the United States. But in this case, it was Islam. And the Nation of Islam is not very close, as Malcolm X discovered near the end of his life, it's not very close to, you know, to any form of traditional Islam. But it is this kind of, this metaphorical rejection of white supremacist mm-hmm. ideology.
We are, go ahead.
That was, you know, that was very attractive to a certain number of acolytes of Fard and Elijah Muhammad.
This is 93.9 and AM 820 WNYC. We're speaking with the editor, Byron Hollinshead, and two contributors, historians Mary Beth Norton and Kevin Baker, to the book, I Wish I'd Been There, 20 Historians Bring to Life Dramatic Events That Changed America. And we are asking you, if you could go back in time to any one historical event or period, what would it be and why? 212-433-WNYC and Danny in Queens. You're on WNYC. Hi, Danny.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. So where would you go?
Well, I had some interest in Napoleonic history, and it would have been interesting to see a grand Napoleonic battle from a safe distance.
From a safe distance. Why that particular? If you're interested in military history, why that in particular?
Well, that was one of the biggest all-day affairs in that period. But I had read also that people came out to see the Battle of Bull Run from Washington, D.C., and I never thought of it as a spectator event, but people actually did go to watch these things.
And Byron Hollinshead, you're a military historian, aren't you?
Well, I'm not sure I'd qualify as a military historian, but I'm certainly a follower of military history and above.
Any thoughts on the Napoleonic battles?
Well, yes. I mean, Napoleon, of course, was one of the great strategists, and there are any number of battles. It's also interesting. This book, I Wish I'd Been There, is all about American history. Napoleon might have come to America, except that he had an ill-fated in Haiti. His entire army was wiped out by yellow fever. Hmm. And had that not happened, he might very well have gone on and really done his thing.
And,
yeah, huh. Exactly.
That's so interesting.
I might add, you might have trouble seeing a Napoleonic battle because the battlefield would have been just totally clouded in smoke.
Yes, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I kind of, looking back, I think that's a really difficult thing because what's written in the history books is very often what's very different. But I would love to go back to the late 15th century at the time of the Inquisition in Spain when Jews and the Muslims were thrown out or killed. And try to prevent that from happening.
Oh, try to prevent that from happening. That's so interesting. So, Byron, as the editor of this book, I Wish I'd Been There, let me go back to you on that. In among the 20 historians who have contributed, does that come up? Do people want to go back just to see, or do they want to go back to prevent something horrible from happening or otherwise take part?
It came up in just one of the essays, and that was Jay Winnick's essay. Jay wanted to go back to the day Lincoln was shot. As you know, the plot was not just to shoot Lincoln. It was to get rid of Vice President Johnson and Seward, and they did chop Seward up pretty much. He almost died. The guy who was going to kill Vice President Johnson started drinking in a bar and rethought the whole enterprise and decided that he'd rather just keep on drinking.
The vodka was just too good.
But what Jay Winnick said was, if I had been there and if I had been in the box when John Wilkes Booth came in, would I have tried to stop him? Would I have?
Mary Beth Norton, do you ever have those kinds of thoughts about some of these poor girls who were put to death as witches unjustly?
Well, they weren't girls who were put to death. They were mature women and men for the most part. There was nobody who was really young.
They weren't children. I guess I was thinking there were some teenagers, but no?
No. They're all, I think the youngest person who's hanged is in her late 30s. I don't think there's anything anybody could, you know, any one individual could have done to have stopped the Salem witch trials, except perhaps the governor. The governor of Massachusetts at the time was deeply complicit in the trials. He later on wrote letters to England trying to, shall we say, cover his behind. And he lied flat out to his superiors in England about how he had been involved, because he, when everything fell apart, he really wanted to separate himself completely from what had happened. If he had been a stronger person and more willing to oppose the what one of the critics of the trials later called the Salem gentlemen, i.e. the leaders of Salem who wanted these people tried, he might possibly have been able to stop things. But I don't think that anyone like myself would have been able to do it, even if I'd gone back with knowledge.
I guess the girls, just to be, clear up the my confusion on the age, were some of the original people to have these fits or whatever they were.
Yes, they were accusers. They weren't accused.
They were the accusers.
Right.
Okay, we will continue with Byron Hollinshead, the editor of I Wish I'd Been There, 20 Historians Bring to Life Dramatic Events That Changed America. The historians Mary Beth Norton and Kevin Baker. Kevin Baker also writes historical novels. And we will take many more of your phone calls. Where do you wish you had been? Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Where in history do you wish you had been? Everybody's had those fantasies, and now history maven Byron Hollinshead has compiled a book of essays by historians and writers of historical fiction titled I Wish I'd Been There, 20 Historians Bring to Life Dramatic Events That Changed America. Byron Hollinshead is president of the American Historical Publications, a producer of books on history for adults and children. Previously, he was president of American Heritage Publishing and the Oxford University Press, and was publisher of MHQ, the Quarterly Journal of Military History. He's the editor. The contributors who we have with us are Mary Beth Norton, who teaches history at Cornell and is the author of history books, including In the Devil's Snare, which is about the Salem witch trial era, which she writes about in this book. That's where she wishes she had been. And Kevin Baker, the historian and historical novelist, his book, Stryver's Row, is part of a trilogy of novels set in New York, and he wishes he had been at the last meeting between Elijah Muhammad and W.D. Fard, the founders of the Nation of Islam. So where do you wish you had been? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Mary Beth Norton, you refer to Arthur Miller's play The Crucible, which of course connects the Salem witch trials to the McCarthy era. Is that typical of how the witch trials are seen in our national mythology?
Oh, absolutely. I give a lot of talks now around the country about the Salem witch trials, and I find that, especially these days when the Crucible is a part of the regular high school curriculum, that everybody seems to be familiar with the Miller play, and therefore, they have a number of ideas about the Salem witch trials that really come from Miller, not from the evidence at the time.
And they're wrong?
Oh, yeah. Well, for example, I mean, Miller builds the whole play around, or part of the play around, John Proctor's supposed affair with his hero, John Proctor's supposed affair with Abigail Williams, the niece of the minister. The problem with this, where he, in his play, John Proctor's in his 30s, the niece is in her late teens. In fact, the niece was 11, and John Proctor was in his 60s, and they were never connected to each other in any way. That is, in the play, Abigail Williams is John Proctor's former servant. She never had anything to do with John Proctor, the actual Abigail Williams. In addition, Miller starts his play with this really wonderful scene of the later afflicted girls dancing in the moonlight and doing voodoo under the direction of Tituba, the slave of Samuel Parris. There's absolutely no evidence in the contemporary record that any of that ever happened.
So, Kevin Baker, you want to go back to the last meeting between these founders of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad and W.D. Fard, and you write, because it would have told me so much about the fire to come and the nature of radical black politics to this day. No doubt, you write, it would also have shed some light on one of the most outlandish plots ever conceived against this country and on the unparalleled American proclivity for self-invention. What was that outlandish plot?
Yeah, Fard actually, and this is a great part of his disappearance, Fard actually got himself somewhat entangled with this bizarre couple of Japanese agents who were actually over in the United States in the 1930s trying to convince African Americans to sort of become a fifth column here and to rise up and whenever possible kill white people. And in return, when Japan won the coming war, they would have be given all sorts of power over whites.
Now, that was something that I never realized about the early Nation of Islam until I read your essay, that these guys were into allying with the Japanese in World War II.
Yeah, it's the most bizarre story, you know, that these guys came over here, Baron Sadokata Takahashi of the Black Dragon Society. Sounds like something out of, you know, Terry and the Pirates, the old comic strip. But they actually came over there. There were a lot of Japanese officers going around the world coming up with these sorts of plots at the time. They had all kinds of messianic ideas. Some felt that Japan should invade Siberia. Others felt it should invade the South Pacific. And these couple of guys were part of this. They come over to the U.S., and they're trying to convince African Americans to kind of rise up and do this. Fard doesn't want to have all that much to do with them originally, but they start attracting a few followers. I mean, considering how African Americans are treated at the time, I'm amazed they didn't have thousands of followers. But he feels nonetheless that he has to respond by becoming more radical, and so he starts to put out more writings, you know, kind of urging his followers in not so subtle language to kill four white devils apiece, and in return they'll get a trip to Mecca and a button.
A button?
A button, yes.
I've been to Mecca.
Yeah, a button with his image on it and a trip to Mecca. And, you know, again, this isn't something that attracts a lot of people by any means. And, in fact, Elijah Muhammad has a lot of apprehension about it. But, it you know, it comes to light in Detroit when one of his more crazy followers commits some of this ritual killing of another black man, ironically enough. And so all this stuff then comes out to the Detroit authorities, and they're horrified, particularly a lot of black ministers and leaders. And the papers start raving about, you know, this voodoo cult that's here. It has nothing to do with voodoo, but that's what they're, you know, these huge headlines.
And then it got really marginalized, and I know Fard basically had to flee Detroit.
Right, and that's when he kind of renounced everything he had said and fled Detroit, you know, and kind of banished from the city.
I went on the Hajj, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt, something like that.
Byron
Hollinshead, do you see a pattern in people's writings in this book? Would they go back in time, these historians, to see the events they're most knowledgeable about, or to answer unanswered questions and solve historical mysteries?
Well, it's interesting. There's a rather thoughtful review that's now of the book that is now running on Amazon, where the reviewer makes the point that, for the most part, the historians who write in the book want to go back to find out the things that are unknown, that are not, and perhaps not even knowable, that nobody has found in the historical records. The novelists or kind of general writers want to go back for the spectacle to a certain extent. Philip Kuhnhart, for example, writes a wonderful piece on Jenny Lind's debut at Castle Garden, which, of course, was masterminded by P.T. Barnum.
Right.
And Mark Stevens, who, again, is a writer but not an academic historian, puts himself at the famous surrender of Chief Joseph, where he allegedly gives this absolutely wonderful speech that is reproduced in every anthology of great American speeches. The only problem is that he probably never made the speech.
But there is that distinction.
Yeah.
My guest, Byron Hollinshead, the editor, and Kevin Baker and Mary Beth Norton, contributors to I Wish I'd Been There, 20 Historians Bring to Life Dramatic Events That Changed America. Folks, where do you wish you had been? Trina in Harlem, how about you?
Hi. Thank you. I'm glad to be on.
Thank you.
I would love to have been in Paris when Thomas Jefferson was with his two daughters and his slaves, Sally and James Hemings. During that time, he actually at one point ended up paying them because they could be free in Paris. And James Hemings actually wanted his freedom then, and Thomas Jefferson wrote a letter saying that he would be freed after he trained somebody when they returned to Monticello to take over his job. And you can get that document, actually, on the Massachusetts Historical Society and I think also the Library of Congress website.
Trina, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much. Elaine in Ridgewood, where do you wish you had been?
I would have loved to have been on Henry Hudson's voyage into New York Harbor, the first voyage.
Because?
I grew up in Queens. I guess I was a big reader and a romantic little kid, and I always wanted to meet the Native Americans who lived around here. My dad had arrowheads he'd found in Cunningham Park back in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And I would just have loved to have seen Manhattan with the foxes and the deer and the streams and the ponds that existed, apparently.
Queens as farmland. Elaine, thank you. Angela in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Where would you like to have been?
Hi, thank you, and I've renewed my membership.
Thank you.
I would have loved to have been in Concord, Massachusetts in the late 1800s at Louisa May Alcott's house when her father, Bronson Alcott, would have Emerson and Thoreau and Hawthorne over just that whole Transcendentalist movement. I would have loved to have listened to their conversations.
What would you have been listening for?
I just think it's incredible that there is this, that there are these periods of time when groups of people come together and they seem to feed off each other and create these amazing documents, written documents and movements. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they were abolitionists and that they changed the basically created the Unitarian Church. I just think it would have been a fascinating thing to eavesdrop on.
Creative and spiritual generation.
Yes.
Yes. So Mary Beth Whitehead, Mary Beth Norton. This seems like somehow tangentially related to the kinds of history that you did in the witchcraft book, because there was also a movement, dark as it may have been, that seemed to stem from its times.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Very much a moment of its time. I mean, I think today we have a really hard time understanding how so many people could have believed that their neighbors were guilty of witchcraft. But what we have to understand is that 17th century America and England and Europe at the time in general is really a pre-Enlightenment society. And there were many, many unexplained things that happened to people. And witchcraft, especially if those things were bad, became a kind of a default explanation for what happened. If your child was fine one day and desperately ill the next, you had to have some kind of explanation for that. And if the doctor said, gee, I have no idea what's going on, because doctors often said that at that time, people would say, it must be a witch. I must have angered a witch who is taking revenge on me this way. And you see this kind of reasoning all the way through the evidence that's offered in the trial.
Stuart in Maplewood, you're on WNYC. Where would you like to have been?
Hi, Brian. I would have liked to have been there in 1831 when Cyrus McCormick perfected and demonstrated the mechanical reaper, which was the major step that turned this country from an agricultural country to an industrial power. The reaper could let one man do what 5 or 10 laborers could do and freed up many people to do factory work. In addition, it allowed the country to fight the Civil War because the North and South could then produce enough crops to feed the troops in the fields.
All right. Anybody want to react to that? You don't have to. Sheila in Hoboken, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Brian. This is so much fun.
It is for me.
Well, I'm going to choose a period. I hope that's okay. It's summer, spring of 1945, the long, drawn-out process of the end of World War II. I would need some astral projection because I would want to be there in France for the first surrender in May, in Berlin for the unconditional surrender. I think that took place outside of Berlin, on through Potsdam, and into the big boat, the Mississippi, where the Japanese mm-hmm. surrender was.
Now, were you always interested in this, or is there something about these sort of complex war times in which we live now that want to make you go back to a simpler on the America on the side of right victory?
You are so right on, Brian. The moral clarity of that period, the ability to feel the unrestrained joy, celebration, and pride of defeating an unambiguously
evil. You can say it.
Okay, I'll say it. Evil.
Kevin?
And yet, I wonder, you know, the utter destruction you would have seen all around you would have been very depressing. There were a lot of people, even on the winning side in the West, and you know, don't get me wrong, it was a great victory. You must have felt ecstatic to have won it. But there was a lot of, you know, upset that this had happened in the first place. And you're seeing basically all of Europe kind of shattered around you, you know, uncovering the concentration camps. It must have been profoundly depressing in that sense.
So here's an email from somebody who wants to go back in music history, wants to see, one, the Beatles in Hamburg, Germany in the early 1960s, pre-Ed Sullivan, two, Duke Ellington at the Cotton Club, and three, Golden Era Athens, listening to Socrates next to a baby-faced Plato. I guess that one's not music. But Nicholas and Menden will be our last caller who also wants to hear some historical music. We have 20 seconds for you, Nicholas.
Definitely. I would love to have been on 52nd Street on any night in the end of the 40s or early 50s to hear 52nd Street, Manhattan, that is, to hear just the most amazing creative time in American jazz history before it was commercialized and you have to go uptown to a club named after a soda to hear it and all that.
The Miles Davis, Charlie Parker, Thelonious Monk era and all of that. Kevin Baker, 20 seconds. What did Wallace Fard listen to? Do you have any idea?
Wallace Fard listened to the voices in his head. an amazing con man, amazingly mysterious, interesting figure.
And Byron Hollinshead, as the editor of the collection, I wish I'd been there. You didn't actually get to contribute, but where do you wish you'd been?
Well, I've been asked that a couple of times, and I could give several answers, but I think the one I would give today is that I would love to have been at the Constitutional Convention. It's a much richer scene than I think most people realize. Carol Birkin wrote a wonderful book called A Brilliant Solution. And one of the interesting things in the book, and it's about the Constitutional Convention, she has portraits of all of the participants. And you realize how amazing it was that they were able to reach a consensus when all of these diverse people with many diverse interests were involved in the framing of the Constitution.
Mary Beth Norton, thank you very much.
Sure, glad
Kevin Baker, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Byron Hollinshead, editor, thank you very much. Of I Wish I'd Been There, 20 historians bring to life dramatic events that changed America. Published by Doubleday. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.